Have you ever looked at a painting and found yourself wondering, why is that worth so much? Or maybe, what makes this particular style so iconic, even if it feels a little, well, blurry?
Yeah, it's a great question.
It really is, isn't it? It takes us way beyond just the canvas into art, value, history.
All of it, yeah.
Today, we're diving deep into one of art history's most beloved movements, but one that was actually pretty revolutionary at first, Impressionism.
Absolutely. A game
And
changer.
we've got an incredible stack of sources for this deep dive, including this really eye-opening list: Top 10 most expensive Impressionism paintings and art ever sold on auction as of 2025.
And some of those prices are just
Mind-boggling, honestly.
they certainly are. And our mission for this deep dive is to go way beyond just those staggering price tags.
Right.
We want to sort of peel back the layers, look at the radical origins of Impressionism, its defining
And then
characteristics.
connect those dots.
Exactly. Because it's not enough to know that these pieces command astonishing value. We want to understand the why. Think of this as your shortcut to being genuinely well-informed about a pivotal art movement, one that didn't just change painting, it really changed how we see the world.
That's it, precisely.
Yeah.
So, whether you're completely new to art or you've admired it for years, we're going to uncover some real aha moments, I think.
Definitely.
And some surprising facts, too, making what might seem complex actually pretty accessible and, dare I say, fun.
It is fun.
Okay, let's unpack this. So, let's take a journey back, shall we? Picture 19th century Paris. It's buzzing with innovation, but also kind of steeped in tradition.
Very much so.
This is where Impressionism is born. But the crucial thing to get right away is that this movement wasn't exactly welcomed with open arms.
Not at all.
In fact, it was a defiant, almost rebellious break from the, well, the stuffy established art world. What exactly were they rebelling against?
That's a great question because it really sets the stage. They were rebelling against the rigid hierarchy of the Académie des
The
Beaux-Arts.
Academy, right?
Yeah, and for centuries they had dictated what was considered art. They controlled the big annual salon exhibitions.
Which was the only way to get noticed, basically.
Pretty much the only real path to recognition and success. And the Academy, they loved grand historical scenes, religious stuff, mythology.
All very polished and smooth.
Exactly. Meticulously finished, smooth brush strokes that kind of hid the artist's hand. Impressionists, with their quick, visible brushwork and focus on modern life, well, they were a direct challenge to all that.
And they formalized that challenge in 1874, didn't they? With their own exhibition,
They did.
organized by a group with a rather charming name, the Anonymous Society of Painters, Sculptors, Printmakers, etc.
Huh. Yes, it sounds quite polite, doesn't it? But it was a very deliberate act of
They
separation.
didn't want to play by the Academy's rules.
Not at all. And the techniques they were showing off, well, they'd actually been developing for about a decade before that first show, since the 1860s.
So this wasn't totally out of the blue.
No, it had been brewing, but it was truly radical stuff for the time.
Absolutely. I mean, imagine artists leaving their traditional studios, which were probably quite dark, focused on detail, and instead going directly to their subject outside, painting en plein air, as they say.
In the open air.
Painting quickly, trying to capture those fleeting moments, before the light changed, before a cloud moved.
Before the moment was gone.
Yeah. Their work used these short, fast brush strokes that just hinted at forms rather than defining every
A
edge.
suggestion rather than a statement.
And a huge focus on the effects of light and really imaginative use of color. You don't see much traditional black or gray in their shadows, do you?
No, they used color itself for shadows and highlights. Blues, purples, yellows.
And here's a quirky detail. Many of them apparently skipped the final varnish.
That's right. Varnish tended to darken and smooth things out. By skipping it, the color stayed stronger, bolder. They really popped.
But that boldness, well, it certainly ruffled some feathers, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The initial idea for a group show was actually discussed way back in 1867.
Really? That early?
Yeah, but it got delayed by the Franco-Prussian War, a really tragic time, actually. Frédéric Bazille, one of the promising young artists involved early on, was killed in the war. He was only 28.
Oh, wow. That's terrible.
It is. So when the exhibition finally happened in 1874, the reception was, well, rocky is putting it mildly.
The critics were impressed.
Conservative critics were highly dismissive. They called the works unfinished, just sketches.
Ah, the famous sketch insult. And Monet's impression, Sunrise, got singled out.
Famously so. Its title was actually used, kind of mockingly, by the critic Louis Leroy to label the whole movement Impressionism.
He meant it as an insult.
Totally. He basically said it was just an impression, a mere sketch, not a real painting. It's so ironic, isn't it? The name meant to belittle them ended up defining a revolution.
It's almost funny in hindsight, these critics scoffing at sketches.
Right, little did they know.
So after that first show, there were more exhibitions.
Yes, seven more followed, right up until 1886.
And the group changed over time.
Yeah. 30. Interestingly, Camille Pissarro was the only one who showed in all eight exhibitions.
Wow, consistent.
And Bertha Morisot was in all but one. But that final exhibition in 1886, it really marked the beginning of a new avant-garde era.
Things were changing again.
Well, by then, many of the core members, like Monet and Renoir, were really developing their own distinct individual styles, which is great for art, of course.
But maybe not for group unity.
Exactly. It led to some disagreements, and ultimately, the movement kind of disbanded as a formal group.
So what does this all mean? What's the lasting legacy of a movement that, okay, maybe only lasted formally for about three decades?
Oh, the legacy is immense. Despite being a fleeting movement in terms of its formal group shows, Impressionism profoundly paved the way for pretty much all the new avant-garde painting that came after it, and crucially, for the further development of modernist art in the 20th century.
It broke down barriers.
Completely. It liberated artists from having to paint historical scenes or be hyper-detailed.
Yeah.
It encouraged them to explore personal perception, the changing nature of light and color. It really taught us to see the world and art in a completely new way.
That's powerful. So, okay, now we get the rebellious birth in the history. Let's really dig into what makes an Impressionist painting. If you're looking at a canvas, what are those telltale hints? What screams Impressionism?
Yeah, what's the essence of it? That's the perfect next step. We've covered the when and how, now let's talk what. And what's really fascinating is how they develop this distinct visual language. Once you know it, you can often spot an Impressionist piece pretty quickly.
Okay, first up, landscapes of feeling. You mentioned they weren't aiming for photo-perfect images.
Not at all. The emphasis was always on capturing the feel of a place. A sense of light, movement, the atmosphere.
Like a mood.
Exactly. Think of it less like a sharp photo, more like a soft focus lens. The definition isn't always sharp. It's about subtle color changes, those quick brush strokes evoking an emotion, a sensation.
Can you give an example?
Sure. Think of Alfred Sisley's The Bridge at Sèvres or Monet's Poplars on the Epte. And both the scenery and that intangible feeling are prioritized over, you know, crisp hard lines.
Got it. Soft focus, feeling over strict realism.
Right. And building on that, Impressionism wasn't just landscapes. They were equally interested in depicting everyday life, normal stuff.
Not just grand events or rich people.
No, scenes of children playing, people sleeping, bathing, just ordinary moments. It was like a window into everyday life, moving away from really formal, posed portraits.
And the texture comes in here too, right?
Yeah.
Especially with people.
Yes, texture is huge. You'll often see really thick paint, layered colors, creating almost a messy effect up close.
You can actually see the paint.
Oh, yeah. Real peaks and troughs on the canvas surface. A huge contrast to earlier styles that aimed for that flat, smooth look.
Like Pizarro's A Little Country Maid or maybe Bertha Morisot's Girl on a Divan. They feel very natural.
Perfect examples. Natural, less posed. They use those heavy, visible brush strokes and dynamic light really effectively.
And how do they get that incredible spontaneity, that natural light we touched on it, painting outside?
En plein air, yes. That was one of the most revolutionary ideas, taking the easel outside.
Out of the dusty studio.
Right. And as a result, their art is often much more fluid, more nature-based, spontaneous, especially the outdoor scenes.
Monet really pushed that, didn't he?
Yeah.
In the 1860s.
He was a key figure in developing it, yeah. And it's been incredibly influential ever since. It gave them this unique perspective, truly organic light and color. It's like the landscape itself was dictating the brushstrokes sometimes.
That's a great way to put it. And painting outside, I guess that directly connects to the next big thing,
yeah.
Capturing a fleeting moment in time.
Absolutely. Working quickly wasn't just about being efficient outdoors. It let them seize that brief instant.
Like a snapshot.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And this was heavily influenced by photography, which was developing rapidly in the 19th century. The snapshot camera was emerging.
Ah, interesting connection.
Yeah, it encouraged artists to mimic that candidness. Their bold, spontaneous brushstrokes weren't about recording every tiny detail, but capturing the overall impression of that moment.
And you see that in their subjects, too. Cityscapes, cafes.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Parisian cityscapes, public places, leisure scenes, crowds and cafes, concert halls, theaters, often shown with a kind of detached observational eye, like a visual journalist capturing life as it happens.
Okay, now here's something that maybe sounds counterintuitive, but you mentioned it gets really interesting. Many Impressionist pieces are actually quite small. Why is that?
Right. It seems odd, maybe, but there were good reasons. A big one was just practicality.
Easier to carry outside.
Much easier. If you're working on plein air, smaller canvases are way easier to lug around. It meant they could carry multiple canvases out at once.
So they could paint several pictures in a day.
Potentially, yeah. And Monet was famous for working with several canvases almost simultaneously. He'd paint the same subject, like those haystacks, at different times of day.
To capture the changing light.
Exactly. To show those multiple fleeting moments as the sun moved. Plus, smaller canvases meant you could complete an impression more quickly.
Which fits the whole fleeting moment idea.
Right. And helps deal with changing weather or light conditions outdoors. Trying to capture a brief moment with tiny brush strokes on a huge canvas, it just wouldn't work as well.
So large-scale Impressionist paintings are pretty unusual then.
They are, yeah. It really shows how focused they were on capturing that specific instant.
Which brings us, I suppose, to the bigger picture.
Yeah.
How did these initially dismissed sketches...
Ridiculed, even.
How did they turn into some of the most valuable art pieces on the planet?
It's quite the transformation, isn't it? From being called unfinished by conservative critics to breaking records at auction houses. It's a powerful testament to their enduring influence and how perceptions can change.
It really is. And that list we mentioned, the top 10 most expensive Impressionism paintings and art ever sold on auction as of 2025, the numbers are just incredible.
Staggering.
Let's look at a few. We can try and tie them back to these characteristics we've discussed, see why they command these values.
Where's good?
Okay, number one, the absolute top, Cézanne's The Card Players. Sold for an incredible $259 million back in 2002.
An astonishing sum.
Painted in 1895, it's the last of a series he did. Now, there's such irony here, isn't there? Cézanne was often picked on by critics for his style.
He certainly was.
And now, he's at the absolute peak of value for this movement. What does that tell us?
It speaks volumes about shifting critical perceptions, doesn't it? His way of exploring form and structure, which baffled people back then.
Because it wasn't smooth in narrative.
Exactly. But later, it came to be seen as this crucial bridge to cubism and modern art. What looked awkward or unfinished then is now seen as visionary. So that painting isn't just impressionist, it's a pivotal piece in art history. Hence the price tag.
Wow. Okay, then we have Monet's Haystacks, which is actually on the list twice.
Right, different versions from the series.
One sold for $110.7 million in 2019, another for $81.4 million in 2016.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine, two paintings of haystacks for that kind of money.
Huh, but it's a perfect example of Monet doing exactly what we talked about, capturing changing light, different moments, painting the same subject again and again.
That dedication to the fleeting moment.
Precisely, and it really shows their value as investments, too. That $110.7 million haystacks piece, it had sold for just $2.5 million in the 1980s.
Whoa! That's an incredible increase.
Astonishing. It highlights the lasting prestige and, well, the financial power of these observations of light.
Okay, moving down the list. Renoir's Bal du Moulin de la Galette. That went for $78 million back in 1990.
A classic.
And a perfect example of capturing everyday life, that vibrant public leisure scene. It feels so alive, like a snapshot.
It does. It really captures that Impressionist fascination with modern life, Parisian life. This one's the smaller of two versions he painted, now at a private collection. You can almost hear the music.
Totally. And speaking of Monet, again, another one, Bassin en Nymphea, one of the famous water lilies, $70.4 million in 2021.
Ah, yes, the water lilies. Iconic.
And this one's interesting because it's described as an unusual large-scale piece for Impressionist work, painted both outside and in the studio.
That's right. And its sale in 2021 during the pandemic really showed the art market. Well, it hadn't completely stalled, especially for top-tier works like this.
Incredible resilience. And the list goes on, doesn't it? Manet Spring, another big one from Cézanne, a still life that reinforces his sort of posthumous triumph over the critics.
Mm-hmm. Rideau, Cruchon, et Compotier, the most expensive still life ever sold at the time.
And more Monet. Several more water lilies. He painted hundreds of them, didn't he?
Around 250 versions from his garden at Giverny, Their fame definitely contributes to the high prices.
And there's even a rare London scene, Waterloo Bridge, Effet de Brouillard, showing he explored beyond Paris, and another Cézanne, still life watercolor from near the end of his life.
Sold in 2020, another sign of the market's strength during challenging times. Each one, in its own way, embodies these characteristics we've been talking about.
Everyday life, light, color, the fleeting moment.
Exactly. It's clear these names, Cézanne, Monet, Renoir, Manet, Pissarro, Morisot, Sisley, they're not just historical figures, they're titans in the art market. Their work has truly stood the test of time and critical opinion.
So we've covered a lot of ground today, from that defiant birth in 19th century Paris.
A real rebellion.
Seeing how these artists broke from tradition, created this style defined by fleeting moments, light, everyday life, painting outdoors.
All those revolutionary ideas.
And now we see how those very characteristics lead to pieces commanding hundreds of millions of dollars. It's quite a journey.
It really is. And this raises an important point for you, our listener. If you happen to think you might have a valuable impressionist piece hanging on your wall, well, the first step is always crucial.
Get it checked out properly.
Absolutely. Get the artwork professionally valued. An expert can look at the nuances of style, the provenance, the age, all the things we've touched on today, and give you a true assessment. Because the market is very specific about what makes an authentic, valuable impressionist work.
That makes sense. You need an expert eye.
Definitely.
Okay, so as we close out this deep dive, here's something to maybe chew on. Think about how these works, which were once genuinely ridiculed, called mere sketches,
laughed at by the establishment,
how they became some of the most celebrated and valuable art pieces in history. What does that tell us about, I don't know, innovation? About how perspectives change?
And maybe about the enduring power of just capturing a simple, fleeting moment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Something to think about. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into Impressionism. We hope you've maybe found your next aha moment, or perhaps just a new way of looking at those beautiful, maybe sometimes blurry paintings.